Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This week, Mel Gaynor.
For me to communicate with a drum kit, I know is a gift.
Mel started drumming as a child.
She said, well, Mel, what have you done with my knitting? I said, Mum, how do you know it was me, Mum?
He broke the glass ceiling.
You never got any black drummers in rock bands. It was the future of what's happening today.
He's best known for his work with Simple Minds.
I learnt that you can destroy a band within minutes.
Would Simple Minds have become a stadium band breaking America during Live Aid without him?
What better place to be than Philadelphia Stadium?
And now drummer Mel is also singer Mel.
Robert Palmer took me on tour with him and he said, Mel, why haven't you got a mic? And I was like, well, I don't need a mic, I'm the drummer.
This is Mel Gaynor.
If you put your mind to it, you can do anything.
So Mel Gaynor, welcome. This is an immense pleasure. And first of all, I just want to say, what a brilliant album. I've been listening to
it.
Yeah, I loved it. I've been listening to this all week. And I don't know. I mean, I sort of read things into things quite a lot. But this feels like a bit of a life's work, like a culmination of all your influences.
Yeah.
You know, and then it's called Come With Me, which feels like come with me into Mel's world.
Exactly, you know? That's exactly what it's about. Yeah, absolutely.
All right, so tell me about the thinking behind it then first.
Right, well, I mean, we come up with the title track, Come With Me, myself and the guitarist in the band, James Ford. We came up with a kind of a riff, and I thought, yeah, that sounds great. That sounds really good. So he came up with this riff, and I started to come out with, you know, a couple of lines, a couple of keyboard lines, a couple of bass lines, and I said, yeah, this sounds really, really, really good. So let me go away and just see if I can pen some lyrics to it. And I thought, hold on a minute. This sounds like something which is embracing you and it wants to bring you in. So I thought, okay, great title, Come With Me. Come with me into the fire, come with me into freedom, come with me into the light. And that's basically where it came from.
It's also something like the Come With Me feels like, and also this track, the first track,
yeah,
it's always like, you don't sing at the start, so you have to wait a little bit.
That's right.
Till you're in it. So it's almost like come
it's like an adventure. It's like an adventure. It's like a journey. And that journey takes you into mysterious different worlds or different phases and different ideas and different colours, different feelings. And it's just a whole journey throughout that song. And that's, you know, that's what inspired me to come out with Come With Me.
With what trepidation did you have actually recording an album where you're singing?
Right. Well, I didn't get the, let's say, the encouragement until I started to play with who was my dear friend, Robert Palmer. Robert Palmer took me on tour with him and he said, Mel, why haven't you got a mic? And I was like, well, I don't need a mic. I'm the drummer. And he said, no, but I've heard you sing. And you can sing. And I was like, yeah, but come on, Robert. He said, no, give that man a mic and you got to do BVs with me because I know you're a great singer. And I was like, okay, all right. So it almost started from that. And that was when I took a hiatus from the band for a couple of years. And then I went back to the band and I started to kind of sing different songs with me coming out the front. And then it basically just started from that. It's a matter of building your confidence to sing. You know, many drummers that sing, including Phil Collins, Peter Gabriel, they're kind of thrown into the deep end. But with me, I had to gain confidence to sing to create this album. And it took me all of, it took me 5 years to come to get to this stage from the start of the album, but it took me another 10 years before that to gain the courage to actually get to sing. So it's a 15-year process, basically.
Oh, wow. It's amazing when someone like you, who's one of the world's most famous drummers, who can have, you know, it feels like some sort of insecurity about going into another area. And I find that amazing because, you know, that you've had all this drive in your life and you've had all this success in your life, and then you have a little bit of worry.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a worry about, you know, I think if you ask any musician, musician to sing a song, they'd be like, I don't know if I can do that. It takes a lot of courage to do that. And like, hats off to people like Phil Collins, Maurice White, he was a drummer before he became a singer. And Peter Gabriel, hats off to them. They just drove straight in and done it. If you believe that you can do something, you can do it. But if you don't have that belief or that encouragement as well, and that security within yourself, then you have to build yourself up to it. And I'm glad I've got there, and it sounds good. You know, I'm really proud of what I've done. And people around me saying, oh, I didn't know you could sing, didn't know you could do this. If you put your mind to it, you can do anything.
I mean, one thing about Come With Me, the track.
Title track.
Yeah, is that it has this sort of Kashmir-esque, and I know you're a fan of John Bonham, and it's... what I said at the start, there are these influences in there. So can you tell me about your why you like John Bonham, why you liked his style? And, you know,
well,
the
first thing is John Bonham was my encryption into playing drums. But John Bonham and Buddy Rich, I first took up trumpet. That was my first instrument. And that was from my father, because my father played trumpet. So I thought, let me follow in his footsteps. And then John Bonham came on the screen playing this big size drum kit. And I thought, my God, this is what I want. This is what I have to do. You know, and then I saw Buddy Rich and, you know, he got into the technical side of it. But John Bonham was the one that really, really inspired me to play because of that bombastic sound. I've always been into that big bombastic sound. Not to say that I can't play anything else, because... the other type of music I kind of cut my teeth on was jazz and jazz funk. So I started off as a jazz funk player, then swapped over to being a rock player. You know, so I'm always switching between rock and jazz and funk, it was that bombastic sound from John Bonham that really inspired me.
What's been the difference about writing songs for yourself to actually like writing in a band like Simple Minds and writing songs for the group and for a different singer?
Well, I think if you're let's say involving yourself within the creative process, and then you have to deliver that creative process, i.e. singing, it becomes a different animal. You know, if you're in a group and you're writing together, you've got your part of that embryo, let's say. So obviously, in my case, it was the drums. I never thought about playing the bass I always listened to bass players, but I never thought about writing bass parts, writing keyboard parts, writing guitar parts, writing lyrics even, because that was the job of the other people in the band. So now thinking about and delivering all different sections and parts of the unit is like, wow, you know, that's something else.
When you write in a band, and I know that you've got your sort of parts, as it were, but it's a collaborative process, and a collaborative process means that other people, I don't want to use the word interfere, but they can comment on what you're doing, and it can change along the way. Yeah, when you're writing on your own, who do you have to actually, I don't want to say keep you in check, but do you understand what I mean?
Me, myself, and I. I mean, on this situation, I wrote quite a few of the tracks with my brother. So my brother was always like my confidant and my, you know, my let's say, what's the word to describe it? He was a guy I bounced off to for certain ideas, but a lot of the creative process in, for instance, writing the lyrics, coming out with the melodies, coming out with most of the changes was from me. So I really didn't have too many people apart from my brother to bounce off. This creative process is just kind of a combination of these different factors between my brother. Like I said, James Ford, the guitarist, he wrote the co-wrote with me, Come With Me. The other tracks, I just thought, you know, let me see if I can write something by myself. And they worked out well. You know, there's another track called Song for Peace. I don't know if you heard that. That was completely alone. You know, I wrote that in a cold room at a place I was renting at the time, and they had an old tinky tonk piano there, and I just wrote it on that.
So let's talk about the single, because Run is going to be the first single.
Yeah.
I don't know, it had this sort of partly Irish feel to it as well.
Yeah.
And then it hit me, Kirsty MacColl, of course.
Yeah.
You work with. So tell me a little bit about that track and also about Kirsty.
Well, that track came along because I thought, you know, it was a kind of a standard track that I co-wrote with some German people, actually. And it was missing something. And I thought, what is it? What's missing on this, you know? And the guitarist I was playing with at the time, I heard that he played fiddle, and I was like, let me see. And I heard he's really good. So I thought, and he was Irish. And I thought, let me get him in on a session and see what he can. So I sent him the track, and he played me on the phone what he was doing to the track. And I was like, oh my God, it just sounds like the Pogues, or like you said, Kirsty MacColl. And I was like, Christ, this is unbelievable. It's really going to sound great. So we got in the studio, we cut that track, first take, with him playing fiddle, and it was just unbelievable. And this was something, I mean, God rest her soul, if Kirsty was alive, I would have definitely got her in to sing this track, because it's just like, it's right up her street. And God bless his soul as well. Shane McGowan would have loved it as well. I'm sure he would have loved that. And, you know, it's got that Irish kind of folk tinge, which I love about it. And it's unusual. And for a first single, for me to come out with a first single with an Irish kind of theme on it, it's like all my Christmases have come true, really. It's you know, and I'm sure, you know, being away from the band for many years, I think if they hear this song, you know, I think they're going to love it.
The importance of you in Simple Minds, I don't think, can be understated. And one of the tracks which you're most present on, I would say, is Waterfront.
Sure.
That track really exploded Simple Minds and made them a stadium band. How proud of you of that track, and how respectful of the fact are you of the fact that you were a very important cog in that wheel?
Well, you know. It's kind of weird because, to be quite honest, I don't want to go into too many political issues about the band, but I think it was sometimes understated what actually happened within Simple Minds. I'm very, very proud of the work I've done with them, and that includes Don't You Forget About Me and like you said, Waterfront, Alive and Kicking. But Waterfront was kind of the pinnacle of us just coming up. and breaking through that kind of new romantic mold into the kind of stadium rock mode. And that was something that became the process from Steve Lillywhite producing such a hard sound on that particular album and that particular track. So yeah, I'm very, very proud of that track. Very proud of that track.
What do you think in retrospect, and I don't mean this in a political way, but what do you think that they may have learned from you? Because people always talk about when you meet someone, what you learn from them. But I just wondered what they may have learned from you.
You know something? That's a good question, but I can't answer that question because I'm not them. But I would love to hear what they have to say about learning from me, because I don't think they so much learned from me. I don't know. Like I said, I can't answer that question. But I think I learned that you can destroy a band within minutes or within months. But I think something that should be learnt is that you stick together. And that's something that I learned from that. I don't know what they've learned from that, but that if people stick together and people in bands, i.e. U2, Rolling Stones, they all stick together, then you get the reward.
Yeah, that's fantastic to say that, I think, because you hear about so many bands who have internal issues. And as a music fan, it's a real disappointment.
Everybody has internal issues. Families have internal issues, you know, but as your family, you stick together. If you don't, the family falls apart, you know, and that's, you know, one thing, and that's what I've learned. And I think for me to say, what have they learned about their situation? I don't think they've learned anything, to be quite honest. I think they've just haphazardly just moved on. And I think they haven't learned from what mistakes were made within that unit.
Now, let's move on to Keep On Believing. Because another track there. And this is a real corker, I think, as well. And it's got sort of heavy moments to this track. And one thing that I've really understood about you by doing all this research and listening to things that you've been involved in is that you really do straddle genres with everything you do. And this one does that. I don't know. It feels like in many ways that this reflects you growing up in a family that had different heritages, you know, Jamaican and Brazilian, and almost like your life straddled.
Yeah.
Is that true to say that?
Well, I mean, Keep On Believing came from the kind of concept of being in a rock band. And for many Black musicians, especially drummers, that was unheard of. You never got any Black drummers in rock bands. And I was probably one of the first to be in a rock band called Samson. Now, from that genre, I was thinking, God, you know, maybe I should come back to a song on this album that reminds me of situation, you know, that period, because it was a rock band, but it was a progressive rock band and it had some progressive overtones in there. So I thought, you know, as homage to Samson, I'd come out with Keep On Believing. And that was something which was, everybody was looking around in the studio and was like, this is a bit heavy, Mel. But no, let's go with it, because we should encompass and incorporate the rock part of me as well. And that comes out in Fire in the Rain as well. You know, that's quite a heavy, heavy piece as well. So, you know, and I want to appeal to the progressive rock audience as well.
And I mean, I think what you're saying is really interesting, because when we grow up, we also have figures that are our representation. Mm-hmm. And I remember talking to Lee John, who I know, obviously, that you work with. And he was telling me that when he was in New York with his father and seeing, you know, Michael Jackson on TV, seeing Diane Carroll, seeing African-Americans on TV was something that made him realize he could also achieve his dreams. But who were your representation figures? Were there any?
Jesus Christ. There are so many. I mean, you could think of Marvin Gaye. You could think of Stevie Wonder. Because Stevie Wonder leapt across a lot of boundaries as well, musically. You know, he went from some rock stuff, some funk stuff. You know, he incorporated a lot of stuff. Sly and the Family Stone was a big influence on me. Again, rock to funk. Bob Marley was a big influence on me. I suppose a lot of the time it was drummers because, you know, obviously, you know, coming from a drumming background, Billy Cobham was a big influence. You know, Max Roach, Tony Williams, you know, loads of drummers, but also a lot of singers as well. Well, I think one of my favorite singers was Donny Hathaway, effortlessly singing. And he was a big part of what I strive to try and sound like. Not that I sound like him at all, but that's something which is in my head all the time. His phrasing, the way he, you know, he I don't know, he takes a simple song and just turns it around, you know. And he had some corkers of songs that, you know, you got a friend. He turned that on its head, you know. And even Carole King said, you know, or who was it actually wrote that? Was it Carole King? I think it was.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah, Carole sure. King. I think it was Carole King. I think I heard her in an interview say that, you know, Donny Hathaway's version was just sublime.
What sort of sound could you achieve with your mother's knitting needles?
Yeah, well, a kind of slap sound. You know, she used to get really furious when I took her knitting needles out and put them back bent, you know, and I, you know, I tried to get out of it, you know, but I'm a terrible liar. And she said, "Well, Mel, what have you done with my knitting?" I said, "Mum, how do you know it was me, Mum?" She said, "Look, I know you want to play drums. My knitting needles are bent." She didn't get annoyed. She just said, "Well, I'm going to buy you some drumsticks and then see how we go." And then after that, she bought me a kit. And so she was quite patient with me alongside my dad.
When were they first aware of your talent?
When I started to bang out beats on the settee, and then they bought me my first drum kit, which was like almost like tin cans. Then I started to play rhythms on there, and they said, "Right, okay, we need to get you a decent drum kit." And from about 11, I got my first drum kit, which was again very small. And then I used to practice in the shed, and I started to speak to a couple of musicians. And they built their own drum kits. One drummer built their own drum kit. And I said, "Well, let me see if I can do that. I built my own toms, build my own bass drum." So, you know, my father was an engineer and I got his knowledge to try and, you know, glue the different woods together and the different plies together and bend them. And, you know, it was a whole process. But I built pretty much a drum kit around this and started to play.
Many musicians I've talked to have sort of said that getting into music was sometimes an escape of their situation. Was it with you a form of communication?
I would say yes, it was a form of communication because although, you know, if you look at ancient times, you know, Stone Age times or whatever else, cavemen times, you know, they used to beat the drum. And again, with African tribes, they used to beat drums to communicate. So it is a form of communication, and that's something which hasn't been lost through music and through playing drums. And it's just advanced to obviously another level, but yeah, it is a form of communication. And for me to communicate with a drum kit is something which I have, you know, which I know is a gift, you know, and I really honor that and treasure that.
I mean, you started to play in clubs at 14, you started to play professionally at 16, but in a sense, you know, I mean, the story of someone like Elton John as Reg Dwight was really like a touring performer hammering out every night on stage, learning the craft. Mm-hmm. Was that a period where you really learnt? not only the craft of drumming, but also learn how to respect an audience from the stage and how to perform with other musicians. Was that the moment that that all came together?
Yeah, I mean, from the age of 16, I was, you know, on the road, as it were, on the road with the Flirtations. So that actually was a step forward, a big step forward for me to play professionally. So after that, after that tour, it was really cutting teeth with many different musicians, recordings, and engagements, you know. So to cut my teeth at the age of 16 on the road was just unbelievable. And then my brother used to take me to loads of gigs at an early age as well. So it was really something which I hold dear to my heart, because it was just such a challenge to be on the road at that age, and you're cutting your teeth and you're learning all the time. And yeah, it was a real experience. Real experience.
Another track on the album, Dangerous, has this sort of fusion feel to it. Can you tell me about that?
Well, Dangerous was, again, it's a riff-based song. Now, it was the whole thing came about with just being in various dangerous situations. And I thought, let me try and get something which is going to reflect that or reflect that into lyrics. You know, when something's dangerous, you know, you don't see where you're going. You can't foretell what's going to happen. You know, it's dangerous, but you don't know what to do, you know, and it came from that embryo.
It's the one with the guitar solo on, isn't it?
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. That's the one with the long guitar solo. So I think there's a guitar solo in nearly every track.
Yeah.
But that one is kind of a bluesy thing as well. You know, it was a riff basing, and it was a riff based blues thing. And it just came from that. And, you know, living on the edge, living in a dangerous time and, you know, all that sort of thing.
I mean, you mentioned Billy Cobham, and of course, and I presume Narada Michael Walden and the Mahavishnu
Orchestra.
Yeah, orchestra. What was so appealing about that band to you?
Well, that band, I mean, I saw that band live once. And that was the Rainbow. I think my brother took me to that. And when they came out with a track called Meeting of the Spirits. And I just couldn't believe what I was hearing. I mean, it was just like, what is this? You know, it was just completely mind-blowing. And the thing is, the funny thing is, they used to support people like Cream. They supported quite a lot of like big bands, Santana back in the day, and they completely blew them off. I mean, when these bands followed them, the whole audience was just, we don't want to know about you. We've just seen the best band in the world, kind of thing. Same thing used to happen with Earth, Wind & Fire. You know, Earth, Wind & Fire used to go on as supporting big acts, and they completely blew them off because it was something so different, something so out of the ordinary. It was mind blowing. But certainly with Mahavishnu, it took me to the level of understanding complex music. You know, it wasn't like, you know, 12 bar music. It was, you know, intricate chords and different time signatures, and, you know, that kind of opened my musical world up.
The interview with Mel Gaynor continues, but I just want to ask you to subscribe. It helps you because you'll hear about all the new podcasts immediately I upload them, and it helps me, of course. So,
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
We go, Mel Gaynor. I think we're the same age, but in the late 70s, early 80s, there was the British funk revolution in a way. And it was the first time that artists who had been influenced from America made their own music. And you were in Light of the World. There were other bands like, got to remember them now, Link, Central Line, stuff like that. And there was this whole new movement. How important do you think that movement was for, I would say, black music in England, you know, in Britain?
It was the future of what's happening today. I mean, from Light of the World came out Beggar and Company, Incognito, and certain members of Freeze. You know, it was kind of, there was a few members, ex-members in Light of the World were in Freeze as well, or played on the Freeze record. So there's a lot of different influences and beginnings from the Brit funk scene. And I think without those bands, there wouldn't be a Brit funk scene. You know, certainly not in funk. You know, I think the reggae revolution came at pretty much the same time. And that kind of took off in one direction. The Brit funk thing took off in another direction. So it was, you know, bands like High Tension as well were in that kind of circle.
I interviewed DC Lee the other day, and she said it was like the first time that she felt spoken to directly, rather than the American music, which wasn't speaking to her directly, but she liked. This was people like her who had the same experiences speaking to her.
Yeah.
And when I mentioned about having these figures that you look up to and identify with, in a sense, all the people of that era, including yourself, have become these identification figures.
I think realistically, I think, you know, and that's very kind of you to say that, but I don't look at it as that. I look at it as that it was part of my youth and it was part of my growing up. And to be, you know, to be, let's say, part of the beginning of that, it's an identification of what's going on or what went on, the history. But, you know, I feel like it was part of my youth and part of my growing up. So as far as I'm a part of it, responsible for it, but I don't see it as like a legendary status, as it were. You know, it's something that was a part of me growing up musically.
Another track on the album is Chris Isaak's Wicked Game, which you've done this amazingly haunting version. When you know Wicked Game from Chris Isaak, it's hard to believe that you can hear that track and say, I can do something different with it. But I mean?
The original is quite haunting anyway.
Yeah, that's true.
Guitar and everything else. But I just wanted to pull it back and strip it back and come out with something which is going to be really ingrained and really haunting and really almost ghostly, you know, because the versions, I've heard a couple of versions of it, and they were quite trashy, which were great. I mean, they really were good, but they didn't pull back the actual essence of the lyrics and everything else. So I just wanted to come out with an actual version which was really gonna set the lyrics on fire, as it were.
Is that your daughter Melissa on the track?
Yes, it is. Yeah.
Okay, but in terms of that, when, you know, when we grow up, we want our parents to give us their confirmation. Was there a time that you received that from your parents where they said to you, you know, you're really good, you're good at what you do? And is this a time where by working with Melissa, you're paying her that respect?
Yeah, I mean, my parents, my father died at quite an early age. But he was right behind me, you know. He didn't see me get to the big stage. My mother did, and she was really proud. And she never actually got to see myself and Melissa sing together. It's great to have my daughter on board, you know, to sing with me, because it's a great family outing or family group. And also my brother is actually going to be one of the other guitarists on stage as well. So it's going to be a family affair, let's say. But yeah, my mother and father were really proud of my achievements. Definitely.
Who did you get to produce this album? And in terms of production, because you've worked with some amazing people over the years.
Yep, I have. Yep. I produced the album alongside an engineer called Andy Brook. He didn't co-produce it, but he was a great engineer, and he was very, very, very good at giving ideas. But I produced the whole album, self-produced, and it was remixed by a guy called Michael Smith, who's another engineer, who's an absolute genius when it comes to mixing. So it was a combination of those factors, and it was me who was actually producing it all. And one of the things which was kind of confusing for me, because 5 years ago, it got to the stage where it was meant to come out just before COVID. Obviously, COVID hit. We couldn't tour it. We couldn't bring it out because it was no point. So I left it alone for 5 years. It was only this year that, last year that it got remixed. And because I just couldn't hear it anymore because I was too close to it. So I handed it over to this remix engineer, and he'd done an incredible job. And it sounds fresher than ever.
What's the difference about writing a new song to actually either doing a cover, or getting someone else's song? Like, I remember you talked about Don't You Forget About Me.
Yeah.
And that came from Keith Forsett. And
Keith Forsett, yeah.
Forsett, okay. Yeah. And then you're putting your own, you're having to sort of define your own input into it. So what is the difference?
I think realistically, when you listen to a song in its basic form and then you present it, which in our case to a band, that band will put its own spin on the track, because we cut that track in pretty much one or two takes from memory. And the whole breakdown section actually came from me. You know, I just broke everything down, you know, and then, you know, done this massive fill to bring it in. And so, you know, it's down to the musicians in the band to develop their own arrangement for that song. You know, it's the same thing with another title on the album, which is another cover, which is Addicted from Robert Palmer. That was, I put my own spin on that as well, because it was something which I didn't really feel that was heavy enough. So I made it heavier, a heavier version. And that was a result of that version of Addicted.
Just going back to Don't You Forget About Me, it was a track that was turned down by a number of artists, including Bowie,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah, yeah. Roxy Music, Psychedelic Feels. You know, it's quite a few people turned it down.
Do you think it's because they possibly didn't see it fitting them, or they couldn't see a way through? Or I don't know why people, you know what, it just seems, when that song is such an iconic song and such an amazing song, that it feels a bit weird that anyone could ever turn it down, but I never heard the demo.
Yeah, no, what it was, I think a lot of it was A lot of it was the, let me see. I think it's because of the verses were kind of a bit weird. They didn't set the world on fire until you got to that, you know, until you got to that kind of chorus. But the hey, 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 hey's weren't in there as well on the original record. So that's something which I don't think anybody picked up on, you know, and they didn't make it their own. And I think if David Bowie would have done it, he would have made it his own, and he would have done a great version. But we never know that.
You touched on Fire in the Rain earlier. Yeah. It does feel like another single possibility to me. Yeah. It feels like something that's could really work as a single. Yeah. Just tell me a little bit about that track.
Fire in the Rain came up with something. Just excuse me, Steve. Babe, can you come out? Because you keep humming. Babe, can you come out? I'm live. Sorry about that. Fire in the Rain came together again through a German writer who I wrote Run with, and that was something which was kind of almost there, but it didn't have that element of a deliverance, let's say. So I came out with the lyric "Fire in the Rain." You know, what does "Fire in the Rain" mean? And you know, the actual writer said, "Oh, that's a really good idea, Fire in the Rain. Let me see if we can piece stuff together around that as well." So that came together pretty quickly, you know, just from having that lyric there. So that was that was something which was good.
Another interview I did recently was with the American journalist Larry Flick, who used to work for Billboard and quite a sort of respected journalist. And he has this theory that the seventh track on the album is the artist's favorite and the second track will be the first single. And I don't know if the listing that I got is how it's going to come out, but the second track was Run, which is the single, and the seventh track is Little White Lies. So is that true?
My God. Did he actually say that?
Yeah. And he said you can go through anybody's albums, and I've done it. I've done it with loads of albums that I've got, and you can see, you know, you see it. It's just amazing.
My God. I can't believe that.
So is Little White Lies your favourite track on the album?
It is.
Yeah, tell me why.
It was one of the first tracks that was written, actually, within the collection of the album. And I thought the original concept we had wasn't really cutting it. So I pulled it out again and I was like, what can we do to this? So I come up with this kind of intro. And kind of rewrote the verse part in a way that it was lower, because the first version we had, the verses were higher in pitch to the chorus, and it was a bit disorganized, a bit disjointed. So we kind of swapped that around, and I come up with having the verse lower in pitch, then move obviously up to the chorus. And that's kind of the way that came about. And the first part was, the first part of the intro was never there. That was a completely new part, which I came up with because I rewrote the track. So that was, and then when everybody heard that, they thought, oh my God, that could be a single. And I was like, really? And he said, yeah, that's the single. And that was actually the first single, which was going to be put out on the album. And then we got the publicity people and PR people involved. And they said, no, we have to put Run out first. So Run's the first single.
Well, that theory, you're going to go through your record collection.
Yeah, I'm going to do that. I'm definitely going to do that. And funny enough, the second single was Little White Lies. So.
Yeah, brilliant. And the second single is normally the one that's the biggest hit of an album. So there you go.
Let's hope so.
Let's talk about Why Can't We Live Together? Because whenever I hear that sentence, I obviously think of Jimmy Thomas in the 70s. Yeah. Okay, and I just wondered whether there was a sentiment there which comes from that.
Right, that was a direct pitch to, you know, the world happenings, you know. I mean, why can't we live together? Why do we have to go through so much war, you know, and disruption, upheaval? Why can't we just live together? Why can't we just be together as one and live together? And that's where that stemmed from, basically, you know. And it's more or less in kind of the kind of vein of the Police. That's my thinking behind that, you know, because really this project started out as a trio and it embellished from there. So it started out as a trio, and for a trio to play that, I was keeping in mind the Police. So if the Police were to play that, it'd be, you know, right up their street. And I thought, okay, let's put a tinge of reggae in there to make it kind of upbeat. And, you know, that's where it got to, really, on that one.
I mean, we're of a generation where music has had such a massive impact politically, socially. And I'm not saying it doesn't today. I'm sure there are artists that are still having a massive political and social impact. But we're of a generation that's lived through that. And one event in your life was one of the most massive events in all our lives, which was Live Aid.
Yep.
And I'm just wondering that, you know, they're playing to, I don't know what it was, I'm going to say a billion people worldwide, but you've got 80,000 people in the stadium. How is that compared to another gig? What does it mean as a performer on that stage?
Well, I mean, first and foremost, we came from recording Once Upon a Time, which was like Woodstock in the middle of nowhere, in the woods. And then we arrived in Philadelphia to a massive stadium with, you know, everybody and their mothers there. And, you know, being introduced on stage by an iconic figure, Jack Nicholson. And it was like, Christ, what is this? You know, we've arrived. And it was just a great feeling, you know. It was a great feeling because we weren't sure we were going to get flown back to Wembley, to the UK, to actually perform in Wembley Stadium. And the record company said, no. We need to get Simple Minds in America because that's where we're going to break. And it's, you know, we want to test them out on the American audience. And we did, you know, Don't You was rising up the charts at the time. So what better place to be than Philadelphia Stadium? And it was just like mind-blowing to play there. Mind-blowing.
I mean, I had a night out with Simple Minds, Glitter Ball, which was in Bilbao. Mm-hmm. And I don't think I ever forget that night. Well, I sort of forgot it.
I bet you didn't forget Derek Forbes.
Well, now, suddenly everyone jumped on me and they're in this restaurant and they've got these guys lying on top of me. It was just hysterical. I don't know. It was one of the funniest nights of my life. So I just wondered, when you're with a group of guys like that, after Live Aid, how do you celebrate?
Well, that celebration went on we didn't actually celebrate that much because I think we had a night in New York. Then the next day, we went straight back in the studio because we were still in the studio at the time. We were still cutting Once Upon a Time. So we didn't really celebrate to that extent. Obviously, we had a night, you know, in New York, and that was it. Next day, we were back in the studio in the middle of the woods. So for us, it was like a shock. It was like going from mass glory to, like, you know, trees and sheep and, oh God, what happened there? You know, it was just like crazy. But it was good. I mean, it was great. I mean, it was a great time, great atmosphere. But it was short-lived because, you know, because we were recording at the time. We were busy.
I want to come to the last track. You've already talked about it a bit, Addicted to Love. It's a track that you released, I think, also in 2003 when Robert Palmer passed. And obviously recorded and was due for release, and then he passed and was released in his honour afterwards. And you mentioned that he was the person that brought you to singing. How he, I presume, you know, I mean, he's on the track, so he must have heard the track, the final version and everything. Yeah, yeah. How did he react to it? And what,
he loved it. He absolutely loved it. He adored it. I mean, I was kind of a bit apprehensive about playing it to him because his version was incredible as well. And I thought, you know, shall we play it to him? Yeah, let's play it to him. So he played it to him and he was knocked out. He was really shocked. He said, that's one of the best versions I've ever heard. Because quite a few people have done it. Tina Turner, I believe, done it. A few other people in the States done it. I can't remember who. But he said that's one of the best versions that he's heard.
I mean, you work with Tina Turner, you work with Elton John, you've toured with Robert Palmer, you've worked with, you know, the most amazing artists on the planet. And I want to ask the same question I asked you about Simple Minds and whether you have an answer, whether you feel that you have an impact on these greats, that you give them something when you work with them.
Well, I hope so. I mean, you know, I think if you listen to the Tina Turner stuff that I was on, listen to the Elton John stuff that I was on, you know, they all were singles. And, you know, it's great that they asked me to play with them. You know, I'm honored that they asked me to play with them. The same way I'm honored to be a part of Simple Minds. You know, it was a great iconic situation. And you know, I just wanna have some kind of inroads to creating that success with my record as well. Not blowing my own trumpet, but I think that we've come out with something which could be quite good and something which could be quite special. So, you know, I think when it gets out to the listening public, I hope and I pray that, you know, that we can further that situation by, you know, visiting them and touring and you know, and being a part of that successful chain again.
Well, Mel Gaynor, I mean, it's a great album, Come With Me, and I really enjoyed it, and it's been great to meet you. And I want to finally say, I just want to thank you, because I think you've made such a contribution to music and popular culture through your work over your life, that I just want to say from my heart, thank you very much for that, and I wish you much success with this
thank
album,
you Mel very much. Thank you very much, Steve. That's great to hear from you, and it's great to talk to you. And I'm sure we'll meet again.
Up there is an interview I recommend. Down there is where you can find all the podcast interviews. And here is where you can connect.